Welkom bij Met Mike, de podcast van de NVMM over de grote impact van de kleine dingen in het leven, namelijk de micro-organismen.
Ik ben Michel Riera.
En ik ben Andreas Vos.
Andreas, we zijn hier vandaag op de voorjaarsvergadering van de Nederlandse Vereniging voor Medische Microbiologie en de Koninklijke Vereniging voor Microbiologie. En dit is een groot congres met allemaal hele spannende dingen, maar we hebben ook allemaal hele spannende sprekers hier. En vandaag hebben we er eentje uit een hele spannende wereld, namelijk artificial intelligence.
Ja, yeah, and this is also the reason why we switched to English right away. Or unless we would prefer to do it in German. Would you like to do it in German?
Please, no.
No, I will not do it in German.
That's very unfortunate for me then, in that case. But so we continue in English, and it's a pleasure to have here Adrian, and he will introduce himself.
Yes, so my name is Adrian Egli. I'm the director of the Institute of Medical Microbiologists at the University of Zurich. I could do the introduction in Dutch, but then only with the help of artificial intelligence.
That's what he actually, how he started his fantastic talk this morning, which was amazing. We could all see Robo Egli, who did a great job in introducing himself. I should say you could still see it was artificial intelligence, but you were fluent in Dutch.
Absolutely.
But what are you saying? How many years more before we can't see the difference anymore?
This will be a short time for sure. I really think that artificial intelligence is progressing in a massive, massive speed. And I think distinguishable, artificial generated content and real content will be an extreme challenge for the future.
Yeah. And we all know a very famous also Harari, who just gave a fantastic interview. We probably link it via the website so people can actually see it there too. But he thinks that the AI is one of the best things there were, but also one of the big threats for our society, and most certainly for politics, our democracy and our finances first.
Yeah, I agree. AI has a lot of potential, but we need to be careful and, you know, taking control of something which goes at such a speed is very difficult to do, and we have to see where to put the right regulations.
Do you think it's going too fast?
Every technology goes too fast, I would say. If you think about how the internet came and how people were struggling and there were workshops and how to use the internet, there's actually an interesting benchmark. How long does it take until a certain technology has 100 million users? For the telephone, it was almost 75 years. ChatGPT was around 30 days. Oh. And this is it just shows you how people are also keen to use new technologies. But I agree. I mean, we need to keep a certain pacing with the education so that people are not lost with the capabilities we have.
Luckily, our podcast is more directed to clinical microbiology, and we can't say that the speed is going too high with clinical microbiology.
Actually, not really.
There was a statement in your talk that medicine is slow on picking it up.
Yeah, exactly. I think we see AI, you know, in our daily life now. If we use our smartphone or if we surf in the internet, we are even exposed to AI applications where we are not even realizing that that AI is behind it. But in medicine, there are a couple of reasons where, AI will be hard to implement.
Are there any examples you can give?
Yeah, I think the data types and the complexity and multidimensionality of medical data, for example, is a huge issue. So if you think about a patient, it's not just, you know, a text which is generated by a patient. Yes, we see a patient history, which is obviously text, but we have image data. We have a highly dynamic environment of a patient, you know, changing, for example, the disease course, etc. And capturing this dynamics over a certain time period and the multiple aspect of different data types, that's the true challenge.
And do you think we will be able to achieve that? to program the artificial intelligence in such a way that it can account for those dynamics? Or are we lazy?
I think it really depends on the questions we want to answer. I don't think that, you know, I think the success, let me first start with ChatGPT again, because ChatGPT is so successful because it's so generable and so broadly applicable. I don't think that we will have such a system for medicine, because you have very specific disease areas, like let's say radiology, and there you need an image analyzing tool. Image analyzing tools you can also use in medical microbiology if you analyze culture plates as an example, but the same culture plate algorithm will not help you to decide what antibiotic is best to use for a patient. So it depends on the question, and I think we will end up with lots of different AI. So there's not going to be one AI, but maybe multiple models.
And I might add that I think it is already there. Like in my hospital's EPD, ChatGPT is already built in. So if you send a patient home, and the moment you say I'll discharge a patient, chat will give you a summary of the history, etc. Mm-hmm. And so the doctors not have to type and write those referral letter, but they have to approve referral letters, and then they're working way, way more. So I believe you're right. It will be more and more different systems throughout your hospital.
Well, that's interesting, actually. Can you use that model to determine which test should be performed, for example, which diagnostics? If you have the story of the patient in your system, that you let ChatGPT decide which diagnostics should be performed, PCR or culture or serology.
Yeah, so that goes in the field of pre-analytics and, you know, diagnostic stewardship. And I mean, you can use any large language model. And currently we actually do a study where we compare the performance of six different large language models. And we asked certain pre-analytical questions, exactly what you pointed out. What would be the best test for this and that situation? How much blood do I need to take for a blood culture to be, you know, sufficiently filled? These kind of questions. And it's remarkable how diverse the different large language models react to that. And I think it requires a lot of trial and error, and also like a proper validation of a tool like that. Because if you use it to advise, I think this should also fall under certain quality criteria. Just to kind of give this example a bit more in detail, if you would change your large language model and upgrade it, can you make sure that it still answers the question from before in the same quality and in the same way? And so we will need a certain quality control also for artificial intelligence and the different models we have.
How can we achieve that quality control?
So I think, you know, I would really look this as a diagnostic expert, how we do also quality controls in other sets. So I think we will have internal quality controls with, let's say, a set of defined data, which we can go and input into the model and then see if the output is the same. So if we have a question which is answered with a pre-analytical question, let's say how much blood you need to take, is it always giving the right answer of 8 to 10 milliliters per blood culture flask? And if it changes that, you know, something strange, and then you have to react. And the second point, I'm pretty sure we will have ring trials for artificial intelligence at a certain point with external quality control, where, you know, you get a data set which is maybe slightly different, and then you can check how portable is your model, how flexible is it to respond to something it has never seen before.
Okay.
Yeah, well, and so will certainly help at any stage within the laboratory. So sorry for that. If we move on from pre-analytics to analytics, because that's what you talked about today in your fantastic lecture here, and you started out with saying that, yes, we can do anything from plating to colony picking to Curry-Bauer or AST test to multi-top spectra to whole genome sequencing. what do you think is the most established use, the one that you could, what would you think that is the first to be introduced?
The low-hanging fruit?
The low-hanging fruit of AI in clinical microbiology.
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with full laboratory automation. And I think there are, you know, large companies on the market which push this very hard. I think image analysis of culture plates, that's clearly the lowest hanging fruit. Generating a very standardized image and using a standardized algorithm to analyze this image, this is easily possible. The second example, which I've not addressed in my talk, would be microscopy analysis. You know, very similar to pathology, where there's a lot of advancements for that. And the pathology slide is really complex compared to a gram staining or, you know, looking for acid-fast bacilli, for example. So you would analyze and screen a slide, and then you can detect, for example, what is the shape and the, you know, situation of the color, for example, of the bacteria in the slide. That's the second example. And the third one, I think, which will soon come, are more sophisticated systems which will help you to interpret the data locally as a microbiologist. So you will get the data and then it will suggest you what kind of additional tests you should do. So for example, you know, there's a screening, it fulfills the criteria of an ESBL, you have a suspicion of an ESBL, and then you need to make a confirmatory test. I think these are the three areas where I see also most benefit for the lab, to be honest.
Yeah, that would help to save. I mean, it's not easy to get technicians, I assume, everywhere. We have a shortage of people, so it would help. It would be extra hands in the one thing. Now, if you extra test would be, for me, that's extra brains to make sure that you more standardize your workflow. Yep. and suggest the right things. So that is, but it seems so still boring because that is replacement. What I want to see, the good stuff, you mentioned red flags in your talk. I want to predict, I want to be able to treat a patient fast and do things like that. So what do you think is there the first thing to come?
So again, I mean, if you think about a sample going through the workflow and, you know, a culture plate is analyzed with an image analyzing. Yes, you can say the lab technician is replaced because the AI analyzes that. But the next logical step would be that the AI is allowed to actually release the results immediately. So imagine a system where you could say, on this plate, I have a multidrug resistant bacteria, and it's really clear and the model is sufficiently sure about that fact and you have validated it for that, then you can improve the turnaround time of the lab tremendously. Because let's say the plate is positive at 2 o'clock in the morning, you will not have a microbiologist checking that plate until 10 o'clock in the morning when, you know, the computer is, you know, switched on and you go through all the amount of work. So I think the turnaround time will become shorter. The problem then is, do you actually have in the post-analytical process the right communication way? Do you reach the right person? We as medical microbiologists, we can get faster and faster and faster if we do not transfer the information to a physician who takes action. Then the best AI system is worthless. You can be fast, but if the test has no consequence, and this is the reality in every microbiological test.
Yeah, well, in the Netherlands, the clinical microbiologist is a very important factor in interpretation of the test, in clinical interpretation. We don't release tests that easily. We first check it for clinical relevancy, the results, because, you know, the protocols in which the technicians work, they cover maybe 80, 90% of the standard care, but it's that 10, 20% that you want to have diverge from your protocols. And well, I think, wouldn't that be the danger of AI, that everything will be 100% and going through without the checking for clinical relevance, and you know, the physicians just trust us and say, oh, this is the result, so we should just treat.
Yeah, that's a bit the problem of the physicians also in Switzerland. They believe everything which comes from the lab, obviously, and I see the danger, what you point out. I think we need to build the system in a way that, you know, the easy things are released. So, for example, culture negative plates, why is there a validation actually necessary? If you don't see bacteria on it, you should be able to release that. Or certain pathogens which are absolutely clear, like an E. coli in a certain amount on a urine agar plate, for example. This is easy stuff. I agree with you. We need to be selective and decide where actually do we need, as humans, still be in there, because there's a certain insecurity, let's say, from the AI system, and find out these use cases. I agree.
Do you think AI can select the cases in which it is incapable of giving the right interpretation? So say, this is too difficult for me. A doctor needs to see this. A medical microbiologist needs to see this.
I mean, AI doesn't have the self-awareness to, you know its insecurity. But in a model, for example, you know, based on the data input, for example, you can say there's a certain deviation, distribution of the data. And so, you know, for example, in this space or range, I bought in the keynote lecture an example of AMR prediction from whole genome sequences, and you saw the prediction of MICs from whole genome sequencing data. And where you have a lot of data, the area was dark green, indicating that there's a lot of confidence about that. And if you go to the extremes in the, you know, bell-shaped standard distribution of what kind of resistances you will actually measure, it was less green, indicating that it feels insecure. And then I think it's part of the validation procedure to set certain threshold values where you say, in this boundary, AI can really decide and is safe, but outside of these boundaries, we are not safe. And I think you can establish that for all sorts of models, and that's the job we have to do as clinical microbiologists. I'm not at all worried that we will lose jobs due to AI as medical microbiologists. I think we can focus more on the exciting stuff and really skip the boring stuff.
Sounds good.
So the exciting stuff would probably be the patient and the treatment.
For example.
But I was told that there are enough systems from IBM and others who already will try to let us know what we are supposed to do with the patient too. So we will see. I agree with you. The human factor will still need to be there. And maybe we, as doctors, but also nurses and others, have more time of caring about our patients again, instead of thinking hard about what to do. So who knows?
We had the pre-analytics, the analytics, and the post-analytics a little bit. What will the future bring us? Will all doctors become obsolete, like in Star Wars?
I don't think so. Luckily not. I think it's very hard to predict what the future brings. What I can clearly say is that in AI, there are very strong drivers. This is the cost pressure we have in healthcare. It's the demand to increase the quality and patient safety. And I think the strongest driver to develop AI is the lack of skilled worker on every level. We have difficulties to find lab technicians. We have difficulties to find medical microbiologists. So AI will help us to generate space for more interesting tasks in the lab.
Yeah. And one thing which comes to mind, can AI account for evolution? Because we are in a field in which everything is changing. Microbes are changing. We had the COVID, of course. Can AI in diagnostics account for that?
I know what you mean. I think this is an extremely good and a very good question, actually, also from a regulatory point of view. First of all, I think AI, when you have a model and you train the model, this is a look into the past. You integrate the data you have available to train the model. if the data changes, your model performance will also decrease. That's absolutely natural. If you have a change in the epidemiology, if you have a new pathogen appearing, a new sequence type, for example, appearing, it will not be possible for the AI to, you know, independently recognize that, unless it is a very open model, which, you know, takes different sources into account, etc. But we're clearly not there yet. And I think this is the reason why certain AI models will need in the future a retraining. Now, from the IVDR perspective, and the IVDR is really strict about that, when you have an IVDR release product, the software, it's just for this particular version. Every update you do, you need to reassess. And because you cannot say anything about the performance within the data set. So that's an extremely important challenge also for deploying artificial intelligence in medical microbiology.
Yeah, but you would hope that in the future, with AI becoming more and more important in all kind of medicines, subspecialties, but anywhere it is that the law and regulations will have to change to a certain degree.
Yes, the law will adapt. At the moment, it's maybe a bit strict and careful, which is good because we need to get to know the technology. I can make you one concrete example from the Multitof paper we recently had published in Nature Medicine. There, we took data from Multitof spectra over 3 years. And the earliest data we have collected from 2017 was performing way worse compared to the most recent data from 2019. This already indicates you in Multitof spectra over 3 years, there's something ongoing. And these were the same Multitof machines. So data is evolving over time, as you pointed out. And you need to have, most likely, you will need a sort of a sliding time window, which moves with the AI and is continuously used to, you know, retrain your system.
Can't we make AI creative?
AI to adapt for that. I think it's a question, what is creativity? because I think, if you look at generated art from AI, you can say, it just copy and pastes, you know, what has been created before. But also an artist gets inspiration. Yeah. An artist walks through the forest and then sees a nice tree and then draws that tree. What AI does, it takes all the images of trees it has and then generates a new tree out of that. So, that's a philosophical question for me. What is creativity?
Well, yeah, it's more in the sense of, can it account for evolution by thinking by itself? Because now AI models are all trained, like you said, trained on old data. Can it prepare for new data by itself?
Yeah.
That sense of creative thinking. Like Skynet did.
Yeah, well, in data science, this, you know, point you now describe of a completely self-aware, independent artificial intelligence is called the singularity point of view. Because there you have an AI singularity means you have an AI system which generates context at a speed and complexity which you can no longer comprehend as a human being. And this clearly needs to be regulated, because I think, you know, it also has a certain danger for society, as we talked about Harari in the beginning. I mean, he's one of the, I think, most inspirational thinkers of our time regarding this topic of human and AI co-evolution, and I think that's an important topic even for our society.
Yeah, and we are right now at the point with computer capabilities going to the point where they're close to the human brain. You would think that the next steps, they have more capabilities.
Yeah, surpassing.
And for certain people like myself, every 5th of December, I already know that ChatGPT is better and more creative than I when I have to do my St. Nicholas poems, which are obviously a little bit heated or chatted, or however you call it nowadays.
Well, I think we have a nice... Well, I think it's clear now we know what to expect from, well, more or less, expect from AI in medical microbiology. And it's not so much scary as well exciting, I think.
Yeah, thank you. I agree. And thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for being here.
One last quick question. Sorry, but we one point.
This is how we work.
This is how we work. And we'll put it in there.
Yeah.
One separate point for you. But there was one point in your talk I really liked, because I didn't know about a new function of GPT-4, namely the possibility to upload PDFs or any kind of material to teach a model. And you gave an example about uploading the UCAS guidelines and then thereby train a model to actually interpret AST results.
Absolutely. So GPT-4 has a new function. It's called customized GPT. And you can open that if you have a GPT-4 account. You can generate a highly personalized chatbot for you, which has certain knowledge. This can be, for example, the UCAS breakpoint tables, the expert rules, and there in an example, and that's actually an ICMID abstract where we have an oral presentation where we share a bit more information about this, how we did it. You can share information and then it helps you to interpret it. And this GPT obviously works very well if you want to write a review article, for example. You simply upload 20, 30 articles and it really supports you writing this review article. It's absolutely fantastic because it has then specialized knowledge it didn't have before.
So if you have no reason to actually get a bought version of ChatGPT and upgrade to GPT-4, now you do.
So this podcast is sponsored by OpenAI.
Jullie bedankt voor het luisteren. Tot de volgende keer. Tot de volgende MedMike.